no sucker more than meets the eye. You suck toes, Brad?
No, I mean, oh, no, not anymore.
Emphatic no. Goodness. What do you mean not anymore?
I've sucked a toe or two in the heat of the moment.
But not on the reg.
Not on the reg.
What year? What's the last? Give me a year the last time you sucked a toe. You're talking 80s a fun mom and dad date night like 4 years ago where you guys just went too hard.
It wouldn't be, considering that the 90s were my big years for, you know,
toe sucking,
for that kind of fun stuff.
It would leather pants and toe sucking.
But I don't know.
All right. Can I share with you a tweet? A tweet that Nicki Minaj wrote?
Oh, no.
I have to.
No.
It's too funny, okay?
It's not funny.
It is funny. It says, my cousin in Trinidad won't get the vaccine because his friend got it and became impotent. His testicles became swollen. His friend was weeks away from getting married. Now the girl called off the wedding. So just pray on it and make sure you're comfortable with your decision. Not bullied. So I just read this, and I don't know if I'm a skeptic. Maybe I am. But this sounds like her cousin's friend had an STD.
Yes.
Like of some sort where, you know, like it was probably a dirty dog.
Yes.
Got an STD, swollen testicles.
Yes.
And then said, oh, is my vaccine.
Yes.
Made my testicles swollen. And then they tell one friend and they tell one friend.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, 26 million Twitter followers are hearing this tale.
It's very irresponsible. It's so irresponsible. And it's so hard because the truth is the people that are going to read that and believe it deserve to get COVID and die. I'm sorry.
Whoa!
It's called Darwinism. It's been around since the beginning of the earth, and there's a reason for it. But unfortunately, there's probably some people scattered in there who will end up paying the price for that insanity.
Listen, if we believed in Darwinism like that, though, you know, people not much smaller than you were getting discarded into the well, you know, not too long before. So they weren't big enough to fight.
The court jester?
Oh, goodness. Well, Steve Caballero came on the podcast.
Yes, we did manage to get him on. It's we had some technical issues, so it's not the best sounding podcast, but I have to say that as the engineer, but it's the content is what all that counts. The content
counts.
It
was great. It was great to talk to him. I was this is one of those people I was intimidated by.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, cuz it's like this is just one of those names that I've been, ever since I got into skateboarding, I've seen this name and I've seen this image. And that was a long time ago. That was like 30 plus years ago. So, you know, this guy's been in my general narrative for 3/4 of my life, which is wild, you know?
Well, and he's a fucking pioneer. I mean, there's a handful of guys who started skateboarding and he's one of those guys. Like,
yeah, he kept talking about it. And I know it was a weird reference to make in the podcast, but I kept thinking of George Mikan, who is like the original big man in the NBA, you know, who like invented like all this different stuff that's used in the NBA. Literally when you do a right hand layup to a left hand layup practicing, it's called the Mikan drill.
All right.
You know, the guy literally invented this drill and, you know, he's like, not to say Steve Cab is a, you know, he's a very well-known name in skateboarding, but it's becoming this like, yeah, I think when you go to the history of certain sports or certain cultural things, there's going to be these like bedrock names, you know, and between him inventing those tricks and then, you know, the half cab and, you know, which is, I literally bought his shoe for my son who's 5. You know what I mean? They still make them and they're still cool. And So yeah, just kind of legendary status as far as that stuff goes. And I didn't bring it up in the interview because he is, through my research, I've seen that he has extensively talked about, you know, the process of, you know, getting signed to Vans and developing the you know, Caballero shoe. But apparently it was, I hadn't realized the original version of the Cabs were high tops. And people were actually like chopping the shoe down.
What?
Yeah, and like duct taping the top of it and modifying the shoe.
I did not know that.
And it became such a regular thing that people were doing that he suggested to the company that, like, hey, like, why don't we make it half the size because people are doing it anyway. Right. And that was the advent of the half cab.
Wow.
Pretty fucking cool.
Yeah. Yep.
So
it's big history.
I was trying to be unique, a unique podcast host, and maybe get into some things he hasn't talked about a gajillion times. So I didn't bring that up in the interview, but I thought it was very interesting.
It is.
Steve is a very gracious person, very friendly and nice. All reports of this guy are very kind. And
before we get started, we got to give a big shout out here, though, to Joe Sib, who hooked us up with the mystery friend.
And I couldn't help but notice, like, you know, Joe Sib's one of the Californians I know pretty intimately.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same accent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I hear it. I don't know if it's like that era of Californian skateboarder.
Yeah.
They all got the same rap. It's fun. I like it. It's very infectious, you know? Yeah, yeah. It's hella tight.
It's totally hella.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, let's get into this. Let's do it. Steve, I know you're a father and you got a bunch of kids over there. What is it, three?
Well, I have two kids. I have an older daughter that's in Sacramento. So I have two young kids, 12 and 14.
Okay. So as you know well, I got a 5 and a 4-year-old over here. I'm in like the first, you know, week of school back. It's like almost 8:30 at night. So I'm in basketball shorts, you know, like,
sure.
You know, I think it's fair at this point, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been there, done that. So I'm feeling for you right now.
How is it? I know, you know, when you're a father of kids my age, you always think like things are getting easier in time. But it seems like it just comes with pretty new difficulties, right? What's easier, yeah, little kids or the age you have?
You know, it's all perspective and it's also all about, personality. Depends on who you're talking about.
You know? Right.
I'll just tell you one thing. The daughters have been a little bit more difficult than the son.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, they're a little bit more. Have been a little bit more strong-willed, as I can describe it.
Right. Is that your experience too, Brad?
My daughter was a breeze, man. My daughter was born first, and like, you know, your first kid, it's everything's difficult. You think it's like the hardest thing in the world, and it was literally the easiest thing in the world compared to my son. And everybody else's kid.
I would say probably the hardest part with my oldest daughter was when she was in her teens, where she really didn't want to have anything to do with me or listen to any of my advice.
Right.
With that stage, that was probably the toughest. That's all changed now that she's a lot older and I feel wanted and loved again. So, and
right. Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it all goes in stages, but, having kids it's never put a damper on me being a parent, or like if I ever get remarried again, I wouldn't mind having more kids. Cause I love kids. Cool.
Is that something like, you know, with the world you were in, did it take a lot of, adjusting to put yourself into like a parenthood mindset? Or are you one of those people who kind of just, rolled right into it?
You know what? I pretty much roll with everything that I get, you know, include myself in. And, you know, I think for me as an entertainer, as an athlete, as someone who's has a profession where I have to travel all the time. Right. I have to make time for my job. I think it's been tough for the wives that I've married, because one of my complaint of, you know, my first wife, she used to say, like, you know, we got married and, you know, I thought you were going to change, but you're still the same.
Mm.
You know, okay. And I'm like, wait, isn't that a good thing? Like,
right.
You know what I mean?
I mean, classic mistake, right? Going into it.
Yeah. So, hoping. You know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's a balance, being a parent and being a husband versus being, a celebrity and someone in the public eye where I'm getting pulled from left and right, all different places. And, you know, I work for a living. That's what I do. You know, it's not all fun and games. And, you know, I've given these women a luxurious life to just not work. And here I am working. And I'm not saying like being a mother and being a housekeeper is not work. I'm just saying go and clock in and do that at the same time. You know,
yeah.
I mean, they expected me to do what I do and then all of a sudden be daddy homemaker, you know, and take over, you know, when I came home. But, you know, when I come home from traveling doesn't mean my work ends, you know.
And is this the same as me? I know, like, from my experience, you know, you come home from a tour, especially something, you know, with a significant amount of time, and it's really, it's like a headspace thing. It's like really difficult to transition back into a, you know, wake up early, grind it day to day kind of lifestyle when you're out there living that very separate lifestyle. It almost takes like an adjustment every time. Was that an issue for you as well with the skateboard traveling?
Not really. I meant, you know, like my previous wife, you know, used to be like, okay, you're done from your tour, you're done from a contest, now it's your turn to take over.
Right.
You know, like, I'm like, what do you mean? Like, take over? Like, are you on vacation now or something? Right. I'm home.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's the struggles, you know, and that's just part of, like I said, being a celebrity. I think when someone who is attracted to our celebrity-ness and fame, they have to realize that that doesn't stop as soon as you get married and have kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they forget that, you know? So if I am ever to get married again, I have to reassure this person to say, hey, my life's not going to change because we're married. And two, you know, you don't go on vacation when I come home. You know, you know, if you're going to start a family with me, then be dedicated to be a family person, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, it's just, that's just a person. Those are just personal issues. And
yeah, for sure.
It's a common, it is a common thing though. I mean, especially, you know, Benny and I are both musicians and I've definitely seen what you were talking about happening, you know, especially when we were all younger, where, you know, one of the guys marries this girl who was attracted to the drummer in the band. And then she's like, why are you still the drummer in the band, dude? Like, aren't we going to like go on and have our nice little life together, you know? But it happens on the other side too. You know, I've seen plenty of celebrity situations where, you know, you knew you were marrying a diva, dude. What did you think was going to happen?
No, exactly. Like, I had a really great conversation with this very famous artist from LA named Robert Vargas. Mm. We were in Biarritz, France, for this show called Wheels and Waves. And we were sitting down talking, we're talking about women and stuff. And he's like, you know, Cab, he's like, we marry these women who are attracted to our fame and fortune. And then as soon as we get together to them, they start resenting the same thing that they're attracted to. Mm. It's like, what's up with that? You know, they get jealous because we're traveling and in the limelight and they're home taking care of the house and the kids, which they signed up for, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, if you're going to sign up for that, go all the way. You know, I'm still doing my job. I'm still doing what it takes to put food on the table and to put a roof over your head, you know? So, you know, I believe there's women out there. I mean, I sometimes I get envious. I'll go to the track and I'll see these girlfriends and wives just hanging out and guys are riding the track and they're out there supporting them. And I'm like, man, it'd be so rad to have a moto girlfriend, a moto wife just sitting there, just supporting their guy, or, you know, anyone at a contest or even like these guys in bands where you guys, you know, go on tour for months and the wife is there at home taking care of the home front, you know. I got to hand it to guys in bands that go away for a long time and they have such a supportive wife or girlfriend back home. It's amazing. And well, I know, I mean, they're out.
Yeah. I think at this point, I mean, if you're a full-time touring musician who has a family at home, I mean, it can't even function without like a rock at the house. You know what I mean? Like you can't do it without it. You would have to stay home. And it's a critical job. And I think that's where the biggest challenges, I think, are like, you know, communicating exactly what's expected of people and what can be, how far people can go. Cause, you know, just cause someone takes on that role doesn't mean they're like, all right, this is going to be me forever. Cause I guess the idea is if we don't have to change, but they do, right? Like if you're going to stay home and you used to be someone who chilled with all the skateboarders, went to the spots, chilled at the motocross spot, but now you want to have like kids in a house and you got to get lunches ready and do like all the shit, they have to change and we don't a little. So like, I think there's got to be some kind of, you know, compensation the other way, right?
Oh, believe me. I mean, I've changed a lot and I've changed diapers and made lunches brought kids to school and picked them up and took kids to BMX racing and take them to the skate park and take them to the beach and take them to church. And I've done the dad thing. You know, I haven't been the guy that didn't want to participate.
Oh yeah. You look like super dad on Instagram. Like,
I've tried, but, you know, it's my bad. It's my bad for not preparing and letting these women know, like, hey, this is the deal. And it was just under my assumption that they knew. But, you know, you can't always assume that someone's going to actually understand. So, I know from experience that if I ever do get in another relationship, and which will probably not be for a long time because now with this band, and who knows where this is going? I may go on tour.
Right. You
know?
Yeah.
So it's like one of those things where I don't know if I want to have a girlfriend. I don't know if I want to have a wife right now because I want to have that freedom to be able to play my guitar and tour with the rest of the guys.
Well, I mean, you seem to have like a number of different ways that you can put your attention between the, you know, the art and the skating and the music. I mean, is that how Urethane came to pass? Was you were just in the pandemic and had a, you know, need to get something else going, or was this something you had in the pocket for a while?
Well, you know, I don't know if you know, I've been in this band called The Faction for
sure. Yeah.
Many, many years, from 1982 to 85 was the run that we had, and then broke up, and then, you know, we spent a couple of years apart and regroup, and spent a couple of years apart and regroup. So we regrouped about 3-4 times from 1985. And right before the pandemic hit, I said, I want to call it quits with the band, because I just felt like it was very stagnant. You know, I felt like playing the same songs over and over in my 50s when we wrote them when I was 17.
Right.
You know, and I just wanted, I wanted to grow as a musician, and I wanted to start something new down here in North County in San Diego area. So I told the guys that I'm only playing a couple more shows and that's it. I don't want to
play. Where were the Faction guys living?
Well, our actually our guitar player lived in Vegas.
Okay.
Our drummer lived in Sacramento, and our bass player and singer lived in San Jose, and I'm in San Diego.
Okay. Yeah.
So it wasn't, we didn't get together. We never practiced. We just kind of like played along to the CD, and then here we're going to do this set list, and let's meet somewhere and do a show. So that was fun for a while, but you know, like I said, I wanted to grow as a musician. So I started a new band down here in the meantime. And, you know, before the pandemic hit, I was actually playing with this other band for about a year. I was playing bass. There was a guitar player and a drummer, and we wrote about 9 or 10 songs. And then we were looking for a singer.
Right.
So I put a little post on Instagram letting everyone know, hey, I got this new band going. We don't have a name yet, but I'm looking for a singer. Anybody want to try out? And I got a lot of calls. I got a lot of emails, texts. And finally, I got this text message from this guy, Tim, who lives in Carlsbad, and he played me a demo, and I fell in love with it. And I shared it with the band.
That was his band, War Fever? That's his band?
Yeah. So Tim was a guitar player for War Fever, but he was working on a solo project by himself, which had him writing all the song, the whole songs, and also singing, which he didn't do much singing in War Fever.
Okay.
So I brought the demo to band practice and said, hey, this guy reached out and I really like his singing and I want him to try out for the band. But the response that I got wasn't the response that I wanted from these guys.
Right.
And they seemed very disinterested in Tim and the style of music that he was writing. So I had to make a really big choice and decide to leave this band that I was jamming with for a year to join with Tim and move forward with him. And
so you just had that strong of an instinct about Tim and his songs?
Well, I did, you know, because I know what it is. I've been in so many bands and I've seen so many bands, and you know, a singer makes or breaks the band. I don't care how good you are as a musician. I don't care how good the back line is, but if the singer's terrible, then the whole band's terrible.
Sure.
You know,
yeah, I do very well, actually. Yeah.
And singers, you know, they're hard to come by. Good singers are hard to come by. So right. I did not want to pass up on Tim. And I felt really strong about his voice, about his songwriting. And it was like music I liked, you know? Cool. So I made that choice. And I think it was a very wise choice because, you know, we're not even a year into it. We have an album being released on Cybertrack Records on September 24th. And we would not even be a band for a whole year yet. I wouldn't even know these guys for a whole year. And we have an album.
So what is like when you started writing with Urethane, rewriting, were you now working on, you know, the demos Tim had sent you or all brand new stuff?
The demos that Tim had sent.
Cool.
You know, I wanted to, I liked his songs and I wanted to work with him to either rearrange them or add some, you know, add my flavor to them.
Sure.
But I wanted to use what he had wrote as a basis because, you know, they went really well with the music he was writing.
Right.
And, you know, I thought it would be a lot more difficult to have Tim come in to a group that had 10 songs already written without any lyrics. You know, I was talking to Jim from Pennywise and he's like, don't let Fletcher fool you. You know, I wrote a lot of those songs on those Pennywise albums and I didn't even know Jim could play guitar.
Huh.
You know?
Interesting.
And,
yeah.
It is interesting because I thought Fletcher wrote everything.
Right. I did too, you know? Actually. Yeah.
So, you know, it's really important that the singer has some kind of talent on a guitar or bass because that helps write great songs.
That's right.
You know, melody.
Yeah, you need or at least a unique voice, a melody, something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, you know, that's how this band started, you know, and I met Tim at a coffee shop and I really, you know, because I normally when I meet people for the very first time, I kind of like meet them at a coffee shop. I don't just invite them to my house because I'm like, okay, I don't want to invite some weirdo over. And like,
right.
That's
right. Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
It's like the rules of dating, right? Like first, you're not going out to like dinner and a movie.
Exactly.
You know, someone you met on MySpace for the first time or something. Yeah, it's a little much, a little yeah. much. Yeah. So I guess the exchange at the coffee shop was not weird.
No, it wasn't weird. And he came off like one of the coolest dude, really humble.
That's cool.
You know, very, very well-mannered, just nice, smart, friendly. And I'm like, this guy is awesome. Like,
cool.
I could start a really cool band with this guy. This guy's going to be really easy to work with. He's professional. You know, he's just it's very important when you're in a band that you get along with the people in the band. Doesn't matter, like I said, how good of a musician you are. If you can't hang out with each other, it's not going to last.
Yeah. And sounds like he's a good worker too. I mean, I just had an experience. I just went and played music with people I've known for, you know, 20 plus years, good musicians, but I've never played with them before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, get in a room, everything was good. But one of the most reassuring parts of this project was that I get home and within 2 days, you know, the three demos we had done in studio now had another batch with guitars over it, now had another batch of vocals over it.
Yeah.
And that was just like an indication. I'm like, oh, good. Like, there's a worker in this band too. Like,
right.
Someone who's real focused, someone who's working, someone who's
right.
Real, and it's not going to tick without that either. You know, it sounds like Tim is a pretty prolific writer and worker too, which is cool.
No, he's on everybody in the band. Chad, our bass player, he's the singer for Skipjack,
right?
San Diego band that's been playing for years. And our drummer Dylan, he was a drummer for the Bomb Pops when they first started,
right?
But they're all very hard workers. They're professional. They're on time. They're prompt. They're serious. Like these guys are like, I would have to say, the easiest guys to work with, and there's no weak link in this band. Like,
that's awesome.
We all have contributed our influences, our connections. Like, everybody in this band has booked 2 or 3 shows this year.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
And we have a booking agent. So we have a booking agent working for us. I'm booking shows. Tim's booking shows. Chad, Dylan, we're all getting these shows like thrown at us. And that's why we have so many shows now, because
right.
Everyone's putting in, you know, the work and it's paying off, you know?
That's unique. That's really unique.
Yeah. It is unique, you know? And you know, I would never be in this situation if I hadn't made that choice of leaving that other band.
Right. Yeah. Bold move.
It was.
So what came first for you, the skateboard or the guitar?
That's funny. A lot of guys ask that. Skateboarding, definitely. I picked up a skateboard when I was 12. Okay. I didn't pick up a guitar or a bass until I was like 17.
And I was like, when I was getting into skateboarding, you know, this is, you know, now we're talking like mid 90s is when I was getting into it. But, you know, there was a very, an obvious connection between skateboarding and music the second I discovered it. Actually, I think music almost led me into skateboarding. Now, back then, was it the same? Was there already this really strong tie between local music and your scene and the skateboarding scene?
Well, skateboarding, so I grew up in Northern California. I grew up in San Jose. I lived on the east south side of San Jose, mm-hmm. which was predominantly African-American and Hispanic. The music choice back there in the 70s, mid-70s, was either R&B, soul, or disco.
Okay.
Rock was definitely not part of the agenda there.
Yeah, you know? Right. Sure.
There was a group of guys that would hang out in the quad. We called them the Stoners.
Okay.
And they you could tell that they would smoke cigarettes and drank beer and listen to rock, you know?
Okay.
But that wasn't the choice of music where I grew up, you know? So it wasn't until I traveled to the other side of town in about 20 minutes from me in Campbell, which was predominantly Caucasian.
Okay.
And that's where the skate parks were being built. And once I went to the skate park, there was Ghetto Blasters playing with music, and the music choice was rock and roll.
Okay.
No, I would have never listened to rock and roll where I live because it just wasn't part of my heritage or who, you know, who I was hanging out with.
Not how you grew up. Yeah. So so what's coming out of the Ghetto Blasters at those years?
Dude, AC/DC, Cheap Trick, and Aerosmith.
Yes.
And I'm like, as soon as I left the skate park, I'm like, Mom, take me to Tower Records.
Right.
I'm buying my first cassette.
And like, what were your parents listening to? Like, what was that? Was the music in the neighborhood? What was the music in the house?
Well, probably Spanish music.
Yeah.
Okay. Or might have been like Johnny Cash.
Okay.
Jim Croce, the Beatles. My older brother listened to like stuff like America, the Eagles. So I was, you know, I was kind of, you know, attracted to that folky type.
Okay.
Type of music, you know, Bob Dylan, the Beatles for sure.
Okay.
Not rock and roll, not hard rock, you know.
Yeah,
not,
right.
My brothers, my dad would never listen to AC/DC or Cheap Trick or Aerosmith, you know?
Yeah.
So when I left the skate park, I'm like, I'm buying those because that's what skateboarders listen to. I want to be a skateboarder. I want to fit in. I want to be cool. So that's the type of music I started listening to. And then as I went to the skate park, I started hearing the music change a little bit. And it went from like rock and roll to like new wave.
Oh,
and I started hearing bands like Gary Numan, Devo, Missing Persons, B-52s. And I'm like, oh, what's this? New, you know, Oingo Boingo. Like I was hearing these like this different style of music, you know. And then all of a sudden the Sex Pistols hit, and all of a sudden the Ramones hit, and then here I am like hanging out with my friend skate park, and they're like, check this out, the Dead Kennedys, TSOL, the circle jerks, okay, the Circle
right,
jerks,
yeah,
Angry Samoans, you know, TSOL, Black Flag. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. Now this is cool.
And you were like automatically attracted to like what in that music? Just the aggression, the messaging, like were you?
I think it was the aggression and the just how hardcore and rough around the edges it was. And it kind of really reminded me of skateboarding.
Right.
Because skateboarding back in the, you know, mid-70s or late-70s wasn't really respected, or you weren't looked. You were looked down upon, you know, being a skateboarder. You know, a lot of the jocks at school hated us, you know, and even a lot of the punks, in the punk scene hated skaters too.
Really? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, a lot of guys, because in San Jose, the punk scene, they were all like in the like GBH and Exploited and English Dogs, and they were all like spiked out,
charged up, and
yeah, spiked hair, leather jackets, and we're like skaters, you know, skate like Vans and torn jeans and t-shirts and so, you know, in the early 80s, I was getting chased by jocks and punks and skinheads, you know? And I'm like, shoot, okay, we're like an outcast in ourselves, you know? And and I was going to like punk shows back then, you know? I had never been to a concert yet. So my very first shows were like little gigs, and they were local punk bands. And you know, I went to those in San Francisco. I went to a lot of them in Santa Clara, San Jose. So.
And how are you getting around? You know, I'm East Coast, like from, you know, the New York City area. So I always wonder when I hear these stories, and I know you're underage, and I know there's no version of public transportation where you live, or some version, but like not always a useful one. Like, how are you getting around to all this stuff?
Well, my friend who used to skate with me at the skate park, named Gavin O'Brien, and his brother Corey, he had a 69 Camaro.
Oh, nice.
So we would go in his Camaro, and we called it it was orange, so we called it the Orange Bomb, and he would drive us to gigs in San Francisco, all over San Jose, the Bay Area. And I ended up starting a band with Gavin. And we it was actually a couple guys from the skate park. I teamed up with them and found out some of them could play guitar. Some guys could play drums. I picked up a bass and I started learning how to play. And, you know, and that's when I found Gavin, who skated with me, and said, "Hey, Gavin, you want to try out singing?" He's like, "Yeah, I'll try it out." And, you know, it worked out. So 1982, we formed a band and we called it The Faction.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah. I have this kind of dusty, perfect, like dazed and confused image of your crew in like the late 70s rolling around in an orange 69 Camaro going to punk shows. Pretty iconic looking in my head, you know?
Well, it was actually more like 81. We were driving in the Orange Bomb, and we were like, the skate parks had already closed by then.
Right.
And we were looking for skate spots, empty pools, ditches, and during the day, and going to punk shows at night.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, looking back, you know, doing for this interview, and I see some of these images of you as a, you know, young kid. Like, it looks like you're 15, 16, and, you know, starting to get into the competition scene. And it just makes me wonder, like, how at that age, like, how are you getting the competitions and getting boards? Like, for you, was it all rogue? Or did you have like supportive parents who were into your endeavors?
My parents were super supportive. My mom would drive me to the skate park, pick me up. I would take the bus sometimes. If I had to take a Greyhound bus to LA, my dad would take me to the bus station, pick me up. If I had to get a flight, you know, I didn't start flying until I got sponsored by Pau Peralta,
right,
in 1979. But before that, you know, I was part of a skateboard park team called Campbell Skate Park in 78. And 79.
Oh, the actual park sponsored you guys.
Yeah, because there, back in the late 70s, there was a bunch of skateboard parks that were built by a bunch of investors, and they thought that skateboarding was the next big thing. And so a lot of people in the Bay Area, a lot of doctors and lawyers and construction guys, all pitched in money and try to bank off this new skateboarding phase and build skate parks, and it crashed. It didn't pan out. The land actually ended up being worth more than how many people actually bought memberships and skated.
Wow.
How are they actually monetizing it? Like private memberships to go skate there?
We had to get a membership first, a yearly membership, and then you had to pay hourly, and it wasn't cheap. You know, it was like $1.75 an hour.
Oh, wow.
You know, back in the 77, 78, and membership were probably like $30 to $50 a year. That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, for sure. You know?
And I was 13, 14 years old and no job, going to school. You know, so it wasn't until I was 15 years old when I got sponsored I got sponsored by Powell. Then they started flowing me products, and I didn't have to pay for products anymore, skateboard equipment. And they also started paying for my skate time at the skate park.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, I started learning the role of being a sponsored skateboarder and working with somebody, you know. And then in 1980, I turned pro and released a signature deck. And by that time, I was already pretty famous in the skateboard magazines because of all the promotion that Pal Peralta had put into me as an amateur that my board was selling. So by the time I turned 15, I was a sophomore. I was making money off selling a signature skateboard. That's where I started to actually make more money than my mom. And I started putting it in the bank. And as the years went on, the board sales grew. Skateboarding grew. We started making videos because the only access to skateboarding was magazines. And when the video age came out, Pal Peralta went with it, and we started making videos to share with people, to sell at skate shops, and so people could see skateboarding on television.
And prior to that, it was all print.
It was all print magazine. I mean, that's why the U.S., that's why California was so ahead of Europe and Asia and all these other countries, because these skateboarders that were in these other countries didn't know what we were doing until like 6 months later after they got the magazine.
Right.
And we were already onto something else. Huh. So until the video age came and we started making videos and started sending them overseas, that's when you started seeing them pick up and progress faster because they could visually see what we were doing.
Sure. Must have blown then, people's minds at first.
it did, you know? Yeah. Like for me, I learned a lot of tricks by looking at sequences in a magazine, like a photo sequence.
Right.
You know, and that was my way of like creating, you know, tricks and relearning tricks that were already invented. And at that time, we were at a time that skateboarding was really young. There wasn't that many skateboard tricks.
Right.
And we started inventing our own tricks. You know, we started being creative in that sense. And that's how you got known. That's how you got ahead of someone else. That's how you placed well in a contest, was you brought something new to the table. So I had this mindset as a professional skateboarder that every contest, I need to bring something new to the table if I want to place higher. You know?
And
that was my mentality. And I'm glad I learned that at a very young age, because it really helped me push my skateboarding and my professional career. And it's taught me to use that formula with art. It's taught me to use that formula with music. It's like you're just as good as your last CD. You're just as good as your last contest. You're just as good as your last art piece. Push yourself. Do something better.
Interesting. You know? Satisfaction is the death of desire, as Hayfried would say.
Pretty much. I mean, don't fall asleep, because there's always someone hungry just like you. And I've always told people, it's easier to reach the top. The hardest part is staying there.
Right. Sure.
That's the hardest part.
Do you think like coming up the way you did in that competition circuit kind of maybe framed your outlook for all the other things you do? Like, do you see like music and art at all like competitively?
Totally.
Huh. Yeah.
the only reason why I say that is because people are judging you left and right, no matter what you
sure.
do.
Sure. Sure.
Uh-huh. You know, they are judging you. You write a new song, they're like, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, I like it. No, I don't like it. You know, you're going to be critiqued by everything that you do, everything that you say, everything that you wear. There's always someone that has an opinion about what you're about.
Yeah.
You
know?
So that could either shape you, form you, or make you disappointed putting yourself out there. And if you learn to just take the opinions of people, you know, like a grain of salt and just do what you love. It doesn't matter if they like it or not. If you love what you do and you do it for lots of hours, eventually you're going to be successful at it, no matter how accepted it is or not. I mean,
sure.
I've been supporting my whole life and now look at it. It's in the Olympics.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. That's actually, it's perfect. You just said that because what you were talking about, something I wanted to even discuss with you while I had you is, you know, I'm watching skateboarding in the Olympics and I'm, you know, seeing this, you know, super competitive series that's obviously, you know, the scoring and technique is such a, you know, step, I don't know, above or to the side of where the contest used to be. Like, what do you think of when you see this, the skateboarding in the Olympics? Like, are, is it just full pride that the sport you love so much is on such a big stage, or do you have any opinions or thoughts about like the way it's being carried over and like presented in that world?
I accept it with open arms, you know. I've seen many ups and downs in skateboarding. I've seen it grow. I've seen it almost disappear.
Yeah.
I've been on this roller coaster with this sport. And I have to finally say that we finally arrived in a place where people are going to get what they deserve with all the hard work. So I'm happy for the skateboarders now and what they're getting. You know, I was there to pave it along the way. Yeah. It's really cool to actually, I mean, I wasn't invited to the Olympics. I mean, I stayed home and tried to watch it on TV, which it was probably the worst, terrible programming and display. Made it so difficult to watch. Huh. You know, it wasn't
Just like the way they were filming the actual skateboarders.
No, the way they were streaming it and the platforms they were allowing to watch it on. It's not
turn on
Channel 7 and there's the Olympics.
No, yeah.
You know,
So
that part I think lacked.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree,
it lacked the way you had to download. I mean, I kept getting kicked off of Apple TV to, you know, I was on like NBC Olympics and then I was watching it for a while and all of a sudden I get kicked off. I'm like, yeah, you're not subscribed.
Yeah,
I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, okay, well, maybe it'll show up on YouTube, you know, and I'll get to watch it on YouTube. And it was just, that was the part I hated, was how difficult it was to get on a television and watch it.
Yeah, right.
But like I said, skateboarding Olympics is going to open doors even bigger for skateboarding. And I feel like there's going to be more attention to it. There's going to be a lot of great opportunities. And what was cool was when the Olympics was on, I was getting all these text messages and they're like, dude, they're like saying your name through the whole Olympics. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They're like, half cab this, Caballero to this, rail. And I'm like,
awesome.
And I'm like, that's so cool. You know, like, I'm not there, but I'm there.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sure. So, half of them are wearing your kicks. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it's an honor, you know, for something that I created in 1980, invented this trick that transcends 40 years later and people are calling it out. And, you know, and
it's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. So I feel really blessed. I feel really flattered, honored to have done that and have it be a mainstay in our sport. And it's a legacy that will live forever. You know, when I'm gone, they're going to still be saying my name.
Yeah, dude, you're immortal.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's cool.
Now, I mean, we're talking about like the, you know, the actual sport side of it. You know, but you know, anyone who's really into skateboarding is usually attached to a kind of a larger cultural element of skateboarding. And some of it, a lot of it has to do with what we talked about before, you know, subversion, right? Like it's always seemed like a place where, you know, the left of center kind of person can have a safe place to go. go be weird, go be yourself. It's kind of always had that sort of spirit connected to music and interesting things. Like, that was one thing I was wondering what you thought. You know, I'm looking at these kids in the Olympics and I'm like, they're obviously incredible skateboarders. I mean, technically so far beyond like what people were doing 20 and 30, like it's almost insane what they're doing. But I'm like, do these kids have that? Are they bringing in that like subversive cultural element to this like next generation of skateboarding? Do you think that's still in play?
I think there's some that bring a lot of flavor to it, and definitely a lot of people are inspired by these kids and look up to them. So they're the representation of their generation. You know, I was a representation of my generation in the early 80s, you know, so they're definitely carrying the torch, and no doubt are they blowing minds.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I mean, look at punk rock. I mean, look at how far punk rock has come from when it started. And, you know, it's just insane how, you know, it's accepted everywhere. And, like, I feel like it's like that's arrived as well, where it's not looked down upon, you know, and the style of music. And obviously, you know, it's changed over the years. It's gotten a lot more melodic and a lot, you know, and
I think that's what scares me, Steve, is like, I'm watching the VMAs last night. Right.
Yeah.
And I see this Machine Gun Kelly character. Like, I don't give a shit about this person really, but they're clearly like adopting, you know, this, what they deem to be emo and punk rock as far as their fashion and their music. And they're, you know, pretending to be that to the mainstream. And I can't sit there and be like, oh my God, I hate seeing this. This is not fun for me to watch. This is so unauthentic. And I think the thing I worry about with the Olympics is someone who's just a real fucking square. You know what I mean? Becoming like the face of skateboarding because they're just that good at it. You know, and is not like bringing, you know, any of that like subversive element. Like, I get scared it gets too big without any of that coming over, you know? Like, I don't want someone to Machine Gun Kelly skateboarding.
Yeah, I don't know. I meant, style of skateboarding, the style of fashion's changed a lot over the years.
I apologize if MGK is your boy.
No. I actually like his music, to be honest.
And you do? Okay.
Yeah, I do. I like what him and Travis are doing.
Okay. I know nothing about it. I'm talking shit with no real knowledge about what's actually happening there.
They've written some songs, some good songs. You know, okay. They're catchy.
All right.
His look, I don't think it's fake. I think it's real. I think it's something how he wants to represent himself. You know, I think everybody that has a look is real. I mean, you know, if you're going to go out there and be that person, I mean, that's you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Sure. And people change, you know, sometimes people want to stand out, you know, and I mean, look at Marilyn Manson. I mean, that person tried really, really hard to stand out. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That took work.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and there was a purpose for that, you know, and he succeeded, you know, because just so like out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you gotta do that, you know, in the 80s, you know, we all had our different looks, you know.
Right.
I got a lot of grief from my own sponsor because I was wearing like Misfits t-shirts and Spider-Man and Batman and all these punk bands. And I wasn't wearing a lot of Pal Peralta t-shirts with my, you know, my logos and their logos. And I'm like, I go to this contest and Stacy Peralta comes up to me with a manila folder of Xerox copies. And he's like, what's this? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, look at this cover. You're not wearing a Pal shirt. Look at this full page. You're not wearing our Pal sweats. I mean, I'm like, what's up with that? And I'm like, what do you mean what's up with that? That's my style.
You're right.
That's how I want to represent myself.
Huh.
So, you know, even I you know, felt that from my own sponsor.
Sure.
You know, and I wasn't being fake. I was just, this is how I wanted to represent myself. This is how I wanted to stand out. I didn't want to look like Tony Hawk. I didn't want to look like Mike McGill. I didn't want to look like, you know, guys that were just always wearing the sponsor's shirts.
Right.
You know, I wanted to look different, you know? Huh. So I chose that, you know, and I got grief for it. But, you know, there's a lot of musicians that said, hey, you know what? I saw pictures of you in the 80s in the magazines, and I saw you wearing a Misfits shirt, and I never even heard of the Misfits, and I didn't even know anything about them.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, they're into music, and they, you know, and because I was wearing a t-shirt.
That's sick.
Yeah. You know? And these are guys in big bands, too.
You know? I heard you were a positive guy, and I'm much younger than you, and I'm embarrassed that I'm the self-righteous old man. In this exchange, you've taken me down a peg. I'm eating crow right now. I shouldn't have talked that way about Machine Gun Kelly. I don't know anything about the guy. I probably just see him and I see someone who's like slim and handsome and younger than me. I just have automatic jealousy. But you're right. Thank you, Steve, for talking me off a self-righteous ledge there.
Hey,
I appreciate
he's doing
it.
Something right.
He's fine. he's fine. Why should I care? You know?
He's got an audience. Everyone's got an audience. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, and, you're
you know,
totally
and that's
right.
Fine. You don't have to like them. I mean, that's fine. There's bands that I don't like. You know, I just don't like the style of music. So, you know, to each their own. I mean, that's what makes us individual, right?
Well, this is why I'm not fucking Travis Barker, you know? this is why he's getting those jobs. He's probably talking to Machine Gun Kelly, being like, yeah, you're great, dude.
Yeah.
You're awesome. Let's jam. And I'd be like, yeah, you're right. Well, so who's going farther, you know? Well, besides that, you mentioned him quickly, and I was just curious. What was the first time you met Tony Hawk? Was it out on like the contest circuits or prior to that?
Well, actually Stacy Peralta kind of scouted him out. He was a young amateur.
Is he younger than you?
He's 3 years younger than I am.
Okay.
So when I was already pro, he was in the amateur ranks So Stacy, who was our team manager and our coach at the time, he was the one that was scouting out skateboarders all over the place and trying to build this team called the Bones Brigade.
Right.
And so when I turned pro, he was looking for more amateurs. And this is where he discovered Tony Hoff, this little scrawny kid that was like amazing. You know, he couldn't fly very high, but he had a lot of technical tricks and he looked very determined when he was skating. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Bones Brigade documentary.
I have, yeah.
But, you know, it kind of shows the story of like how he discovered Tony and he put Tony on the team. And, you know, we were fine with that. You know, we trusted, I mean, Stacy trusted in us. So I wasn't going to, you know, I really didn't actually have a say of who was on and who wasn't on the team.
Right.
So just kind of went with the flow with everything. And Tony, over the years, you know, turning pro, he surpassed us, you know, because of his passion, his drive. He definitely worked a lot harder than everybody else on the team, and he still works hard to this day.
So in your mind, is that the thing that separates that guy, is just a work ethic? Like, he's just got crazy work ethic?
That's what separates everybody, is work ethic. You know, I don't believe in natural talent. I believe that everyone has to work super hard at what they do. We just don't see the work people put in. We only see the results. We're not around people 24/7. We don't know what they think. We don't know what they drink. We don't know how many hours. We don't know the sacrifice that people put into things. So it's very easy to be like, oh, well, that guy's good at that because he's naturally talented. I call bull on that, you know.
Yeah.
Because fear plays a huge role in decision making and what we pick and choose, what we want to be associated with or participate. And some people are just more courageous than others too.
Right.
So, you know, you got to put that in place too. So you take a guy that's very talented. That's a very courageous guy. That's a very courageous woman. Because they have put themselves in a vulnerable place to be criticized. You know, I learned a lot in skateboarding. You got to fail to succeed. That's the main thing that you learn in skateboarding, is you fall some more, and then you make it, you know. And I feel like I've applied that to music. I've played that to art. Everything that I associate myself with, you got to put the hours in. And there's some people that just aren't patient. They're not patient enough to put the hours in. And what I've learned, the definition of patience is long suffering. That's a perfect definition of patience. And if you aren't willing to suffer for a long time, you're not going to be good at anything.
Wow. That's intense. It's true. I saw you in a different interview, you had an explanation on how not to get injured, where you said getting your mind in the right mindset and being very positive is one of the ways. And I was thinking for a second, I'm like, I don't exactly understand what one has to do with the other, but it was interesting. Is it more of like when you go into something with like a positive mental attitude like that, it helps to succeed because you're not second guessing yourself? Is that the idea behind that?
It is, especially if you're skating a handrail that's like more than like 10 stairs and you roll up to it, you better be prepared and you better not second guess it when you're approaching it, because that's when you get hurt. You have to have full confidence of knowing what you're going to do, how you're going to execute the trick, and see yourself rolling away.
So you have a full visualization before you're doing it.
Always. Everything starts with a dream. Everything starts with a vision in life. Nothing that's been created hasn't started with a dream.
Yeah.
You know, hasn't started with a thought. You know, I invented this trick called the Caballero, which is a fakie 360 ollie air, which had never been done. So I didn't have anything to like look at to be influenced or inspired by. I had to like imagine that in my head.
Blows my mind with any of these kind of tricks is like the first time somebody does something like that, how the fuck did you like, how did you conceive of it or that it could be done, you know?
Well, sometimes things happen by mistake.
Right. Right.
You know, and sometimes you do an accident, like you're trying to learn something and you make an accident, like, oh, wait, that kind of works.
Right.
You know, and I feel that's the same with art. I feel that's the same with music. Like, let's say you're playing something, you play a wrong chord. You're like, wait, that actually sounds kind of cool.
Yeah.
I was supposed to play this chord, but I went and did this chord, or I was supposed to hit a drum beat and I messed up. But no way, that actually, I like that. Right. You know, so, you know, when you talked about street skating and where street skating is now, a lot of that has to do with the Tony Hawk video game, where in 99 and the year 2000, Activision approached Tony Hawk and created this game. And these tricks that you could do on this game, you could only really do them with your hands and your fingers.
Right.
And you could, like, do multiple tricks by how fast your fingers were and how you use the controller. And I kid you not, the tricks that kids are doing now, I would have never imagined that I was doing these tricks with my fingers on a video game 20 years ago.
Right.
And these kids don't know any better. They're like, what? What do you mean? Like, this isn't real? Like, you can't actually do this? You know, so it's kind of fun and innocent that the fact that these kids see the stuff on video games, imagine, and like, well, that can be done, right? And they try it, and sure enough,
wow,
these kids are doing video game tricks now.
That's crazy. Like,
I can 50-50 grind on the bottom of this helicopter.
No, I mean, it just goes as far as, you know, like, as far back as the Wright brothers, like, thinking, right, like they fly. I mean, you know, like, dude, are you crazy? Like, you're going to fly like a bird? Yeah, why not?
Yeah, sure. That's so funny. Speaking of, when Brad asked you that, like, is it the same in music where, you know, you're, say, listening to, oh, like, I'm listening to a new Bad Religion record and there's this great song and I'm going to sit down with my, you know, guitar and, you know, not write the same song, but come up with something that I'm inspired by this. Like, who were the people who were, like, inspiring you to come up with new tricks? Like, who were you vicking, like, your little pieces from to, like, come up with your own shit at that time?
Well, when I was an amateur, there was a pro skateboarder at the time named Eddie Alguera.
Okay.
Who lived near Colton Pipeline area. And he was the top guy, and he was the guy that was pushing the limits of skateboarding progression. And he was on top because he was so adamant of progressing the sport that he would try these tricks that no one had ever done before.
Mm.
So I didn't get to see them until I saw them in the magazines.
Right.
You know, and once I saw something in the magazine, I saw a sequence of it. I'm like, I'm going back to the skate park and I'm going to learn this trick, because it's a lot easier to see something, to create something when you've seen it done already.
Right.
But to actually make something from nothing, it takes a lot of passion and drive and a positive mental attitude, like believing in yourself that you can do this, you know? And that's the power of the mind. The mind is very creative, and I feel like we are very creative beings. You know, that's why I believe in God, because I believe that God created everything. I meant, you cannot build something from nothing. Something had to design, like a building. A building just doesn't pop up.
Right.
Right. There's a designer behind this building to build this building. And that's what I feel like life is all about. Like, there, someone created all this. Because there's so much beauty and so much diversity in this world that it just doesn't happen from a big bang. You don't just bang out of nothing and all of a sudden you got, you know, I'm doing a podcast with you. You know what I mean?
You think this is a divine podcast? That's nice.
Hey, if my divine path was to be a podcast host. All right.
You know, someone thought it up. I mean, someone thought of a phone. Someone thought of a computer. someone thought of something, you know, we're created in the image of God. We are creators. We're capable of creating, thinking, making things from not, you know, from just our mind, our thoughts, our dreams, our passions, you know? So that, you know, that's where I'm at in life. I feel like we have a purpose, and I feel like it's endless possibilities. You think that you're just a podcast guy? You're not. You know, you can be anything. You can be anything that you want to be.
Oh no, I don't think that. I think people are all a very rich tapestry, myself included. I do.
No, yeah, and for me, you know, that's why I'm into so many things, because I believe that I'm capable of anything I put my heart and mind to. You know, I don't even know myself. There's stuff that I've never even discovered yet about myself.
Mm.
You know,
right?
Because I haven't tapped into it yet.
So what's next? I mean, you've taken on.
Who knows?
Lot of stuff going. Are you going to be a pilot next? Are you going to hot air balloons? Like,
if I was passionate about flying, I would become the best pilot there is.
Yeah.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying? And I feel like because I have that attitude, everyone else does. You know, you can have that attitude if you believe in yourself.
I noticed you had a thing for Evel Knievel. Is this the reason you're drawn to him?
Well, I mean, he offered something to people in the mid 70s that were intrigued and inspired and just wowed over. I mean, he was flirting with death. You know, he was doing something that no one had ever done before.
Yeah,
and was bringing some excitement. You know, obviously, there's an excitement to danger, you know, of like, you can get hurt or you cannot get hurt. Is he going to make it? Is he not going to make it? You know, there's a suspense. There's a thrill of suspense in that, you know? So anything that, can cause pain or harm, there's this part of you that says I'm attracted to that or I'm not attracted to that, you know? So, you know, it's just exciting. Well, it's exciting.
It's kind of like the oldest form of entertainment is hurting yourself, right? Like,
well, no,
jumping off of high places.
I don't want to hurt myself.
No, but no. I'm saying that's why the people, you know, that's where the excitement comes in is like, is he going to hurt himself? You know?
It's like this. So when I was a little kid, there was this huge tree that was at my neighbor's, and it's like, I'm going to climb to the top of that, right? You know? And it's like, but if I really thought about it, if my mom saw me, she'd be like, no, you're not. Right. I'm like, why not? She goes, if you fall, you could break a bone or you could die.
Right.
But when you're a kid, you're like, you don't even think about that. You're like, I'm climbing this tree. I don't care. And when I get to the top, I'm going to be cool because no one else did this.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm saying? So it starts at a very young age. We are intrigued with danger.
Do you think there's like a, you know, I guess one of the far extremes I think about is, you know, the climber, Alex, I forget his name, but he's the free solo guy, you know, the one who's does the mountain climbing without ropes.
I didn't get to see that movie. I heard lots about it, Free Solo. So I definitely want to still see that movie, but I heard that's a great movie.
Yeah, it's really cool and it's intense. You know, the actual physical aspect of what he's doing is cool, but, you know, the interviews with him and his views about, you know, maybe how close to death you sort of are, if you are realistic about it on a day-to-day level. And, you know, that's what I was wondering with the question is, like, what do you think is driving people to that? Is there like sort of a almost divine, like spiritual experience that one has when you kind of push yourself to that limit? Like, do you get the same kind of feeling you get when you pray or when you get spiritual? Does it take you to like the middle place?
I want to say it's I want to say it's experience. I want to say it's like so let me say with like skateboarding, there's no way that I could explain what it feels like to skateboard, because unless you do it, unless you go through all the hard work and the pain and the suffering, you will never understand what it feels like. Like for me, like I will never understand. I'm not going to say never. I can't understand what it feels like to surf big waves because I'm not there. I haven't put the work into it, but I know it must be an amazing feeling because people do it, you know? So, you know, it's that feeling of gratification you get of like pushing yourself and doing something that no one else has done and believing in yourself and accomplishing a goal, for yourself. You feel like you, there's a sense of purpose and a sense of like belonging, that you have something to offer this world that means something to somebody. And in the end, it's true. In the end, it's true. It doesn't matter how much money you make. It doesn't matter how good you are at something. It's all about your heart and how you treat people and how you feel about people. And the best people are the best people with the most kindest, humblest hearts. And those are the people that are more attractive than someone who's rich and famous and who's an asshole.
Yeah, 100%.
You're right.
You know what I'm saying?
Can't argue with that.
I do.
So I've had to deal with that as a person myself. Is I feel like I'm trying to be the best person I can in my heart. And that's why I gravitated towards a spirituality and Christianity, because being sponsored by the best skateboard company or having the most money isn't going to teach me how to be a good person and how to treat people, you know, the best way. You know, I can only learn from my parents or my peers, but you know, they may be a bad influence. They may not be the best influence. You know, you're only as good as the people you hang out with, you know?
Right.
But I've learned through reading scripture and reading the Bible that this is the way that God wants us to be around people. And it's a very difficult road because the heart is deceitful. It wants other things that are harmful towards us and other people. We can't, we're not wise enough to see the future. We're very short-sighted as human beings. Mm-hmm. And the Bible is full of prophecies of people that have, things have happened in the past that still happen today. So there's nothing new under the sun. Like that, nothing right now will ever surprise me. I don't care if you feel like you know somebody, if they out of the ordinary, they do something that you don't, that's out of the blue. Like you're like, oh my goodness. Like I thought I knew that person. Like, no, it's just, you know, you're not capable of knowing anyone because the person that you meet, they're only going to allow so much information for you to know because they want to be looked at in a good light. But right. If you really know, if you can really see somebody's heart and what their thoughts are and what they've done in the past, I mean, man, you know, we've done a lot of terrible things that we're not proud of. And people really like hold on to those things and they feel like, well, you're such a bad person because like 20 years ago you did this. And like, okay, that was 20 years ago. But you know, people change.
Yeah.
People's hearts change, you know? So we're very, as human beings, we're very judgmental, very critical, very like, you know, and that's the thing about fame and fortune. It's like, you can work yourself way all the way to the top, right? And do all these great things. And then as soon as you say something wrong or do something wrong, they'll just chop you down. The same people who lift you up will smash you to the ground in a second.
Uh-huh.
If they knew everything about you. And that's why it sucks to be a politician or something, because people are just out there to just dig up dirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they'll like, you'll do all these great things, but then look what he did when he was 10.
Right. Speaking of the past, I'm going to do a 360 here because we have a little segment on this podcast that to lighten the mood a little bit sometimes, but it's a little game. It's called Mystery Friend. So I reached out and found a friend of yours, and they told, you know, and asked them for a prompt about something, maybe something funny that happened to you in the past. And so you're going to tell us the story or elaborate on it. And then you have to try to guess who told me the story. So this is a very old story.
Now, is this music, skateboarding, or art?
Oh, well, I've got a little bit of that, but this is the first one has to do with your first girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
And her parents, who I guess walked in on you in the act. Is this true?
That was my girlfriend Denise, and she used to love skipping school. She loved it. And I had a little Honda MB550 that I would just, she'd call me up and she'd be like, I'm not going to school today. parents are at work. You want to come over? And I'm like, it's raining outside. I'm on a motorcycle. Okay, I'll be over in a second.
Right. Yeah.
And I just,
what age are we talking here?
Well, I was 18. She was 15 or 16.
Okay.
So if that happened now, I'd probably been thrown in jail. Okay.
Yeah, 18-year-old with a motorcycle. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're toast. You're toast, exactly. Buddy. Yeah.
This is what's hilarious about this. I'd never been with a woman before. She's the one that taught me my sexuality. So I was a virgin at that time.
Okay.
Yeah. So being 18 years old and a virgin and learning about sexuality, I mean, it's very exciting, you know, and fun.
Yeah.
And you're like, I want to do this a lot.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
And she was willing. So
speaking of passions we take on as young people. Yeah.
And I just remember we were, you know, at her house in her bed, and then all of a sudden her parents walk in and I'm running towards the closet naked. And I'm super, super embarrassed, and I'm hiding in there. And then finally they leave and they're like questioning her, like, who is that naked butt that just ran into the in the closet?
Oh no.
Is that your boyfriend, Steve? They were like a, you know, kind of a like hippie family, and just like really like they liked me. They loved me.
So they were breaking your balls.
Pretty much. They just thought it was funny. And
so what do you think? You're naked in the closet, just like, oh my God, like
I was shitting. I was like, oh my goodness. And I would eat dinner with them, and they'd make me dinner all the time, and
yeah,
and I was like so embarrassed.
Where are your clothes at this point? Like,
they're on the ground.
You didn't even pick up the evidence. You're clearly in the closet.
I'm hearing someone scramble, and I'm like running into like the closet. Yeah. You know,
you don't have a lot of options at that point. It's either run into the closet or just lay there and just be like, hey, what's up? You know?
That was 1982. Yeah.
Well, do you have any idea who might have clued me into that story?
Well, Denise, that was my girlfriend at the time.
It wasn't her.
Was it Gavin, our singer?
It was Gavin, yeah. And it's funny
he's the one that introduced me to her.
Oh, boy. It was Gavin, and he had when I first asked him for a question, he gave me another one, which I'm going to ask you anyway, because it's a good question, but it wasn't quite as juicy. It was juicy in a different way. It's a question about cheating, but not about sex. He said that in the late 80s, early 90s, when he was at Santa Cruz, that you were actually a little bit upset with Powell and had come over and they made you a couple decks, and that you were skating on Santa Cruz decks for a while. Like, kind of secretly, I guess. Is that true?
No.
No.
No. There was like three times I had gotten upset with my relationship with Powell. And one time I was talking to Novak, Rich Novak from Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. to see if I could ride for Santa Cruz, because I was just very unhappy with, and I think one of them was when the Stacy brought those Xerox machine photos and giving me crap about wearing
trying to censor your Misfits t-shirts.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is like pretty lame. Like, you're selling my deck. My deck was like one of the best selling decks in 87, 88. I was making $15,000 a month on board sales.
Crazy.
You know, and so I was making $250,000 a year in 1987.
Nice.
And these guys are giving me crap about wearing a t-shirt.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, I think I'll quit. If you're not happy with me, I'll quit. So I did reach out to Santa Cruz. I reached out to Rich Novak, and he directed me to Bob Denike. And I had a conversation with him, like, hey, maybe it's time for me to switch to a different team. But when I had a meeting with them, Santa Cruz didn't have an offer on the table that I couldn't resist, you know.
Okay.
So I was wondering what you thought was the best era of skateboard graphics, and if you maybe had like a Mount Rushmore of like all time best deck artwork. Like, do you have an all time favorite or like a top four, like a Mount Rushmore?
Well, I mean, definitely, I will have to say skateboard artists, and definitely Court Johnson from Pal Peralta. A lot of his graphics from the 80s were super popular. Jim Phillips from Santa Cruz, a lot of his graphics were pretty amazing in the 80s. I would have to say those two were the strongest back in the day. And a lot of stuff that Pusshead drew for Zorlac. Those are timeless as well. But if you look at skateboard history and you look at all the popular graphics at that time, the leading guys were Pal Peralta and Santa Cruz, as far as the best artist out there.
And what, when you're through the years, what were your personal favorites where you're like, shit, I got to get that board. It just looks too cool.
Well, I did collect skateboards when I was growing up.
Yeah. You know, were just riding your own, right? Like when you were growing up.
Pretty much. I wasn't, you know, I didn't really think that people would want these things like 30, 40 years later.
Right. You
know? If I would have known that, I would have kept a lot of people's boards in pristine condition, and I would have kept a lot of mine in pristine condition, you know. But like I said, I was sponsored. I was riding them, destroying them. I didn't save anything, you know, so I didn't really plan ahead. I wasn't that wise. You know, if I had parents that were, you know, like a perfect example, Christian Osoy, his dad had a vision for Christian, and he looked at Christian as someone who was special, and that everything that he had was special, and he pumped Christian up, you know, like big time, to where he kept every single board that Christian rode back in the 80s.
Wow.
So Christian has a landmine of like a treasure chest of all 80s decks that were, you know, shown in he's got a gold mine like of boards from the 80s that he could sell for thousands and thousands of dollars, because there's photographs of him riding these things in the magazines.
Yeah.
And he's got tons of them.
Wow.
And what's the aftermarket for this stuff at this point? Like, what are some of these pristine like 80s decks going for it? I mean, we're in the thousands.
Oh yeah, for sure. Depends on the skateboarder, depends on the graphic, depends on the rarity of the board, but I've seen them go from $5,000 to like $20,000 for just the deck.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it just really, it's supply and demand. And sure, a lot of the guys who rode these decks when they were kids all have really good jobs now and have made a lot of money. And now I'm hearing these guys that have made a bunch of money off Bitcoin and NFTs or have money to spare and just throwing money away, that they're bidding ridiculously on these boards just to have them.
Yeah, you know, apparently something switched in the pandemic, because there's a, I heard the podcast where apparently the trading card market is at like an all-time high. I know people who run record stores, like, you know, resale for certain like records and used stuff is at, it's almost as if people are transferring their idea of what assets are and finding these new and different ways to like collect assets and make money. And I bet the skateboard decks are, you know, part of that as well.
No, there are, there's a lot of enthusiasts and people that, like I said, grew up on this stuff and they want to be known as the person to have this one board, you know? So it's really, to be honest with you, it's all perspective. Like, this stuff is worth nothing and it's worth tons of money.
Right.
And that's where I'm going to go back resorting to, you know, my relationship with God and showing me that all this stuff is just materialistic things that we're not taking with us when we die, you know? So, a lot of people, who own a lot of things, don't actually own things. The things own them, and they either make or break a person. And what it comes down to is like a materialistic thing is that's what it is. It's nothing more, nothing less. And it at one point, this thing that you crave and you love means so much to you, but the next person standing next to you could care less about that.
Sure.
So what is it really worth something, or is it worth a lot?
Things are only worth what people value. You know, like that's the thing with all of this is I had an instance once where I was at an auction and I brought some of my band's records, you know, Gaslit Anthem records, nice and sealed, and you know, these really nice looking pieces. I'm like, all right, these are going to go to the auction. The money will go to a decent place, blah, blah, blah. Before the night was out, there was 11 bids on an R. Kelly gold disc and zero bids on ours. You know, it's just what people value, right?
Right. It's all perspective.
And I had some money on the R. Kelly one too. I got to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, you want that piece in your house, don't you? Well, I have it.
And so many people are so afraid to let go of things. It's like, you know, we're just borrowing these things. They're not, we don't really own them. It's like, let someone else enjoy it for a little bit. You know, it's like I had these decks. Okay. For example, we'll go back to skateboarding. I had a lot of my Team Riders decks from the 80s, just kind of in a closet. I just kept them because I'm like, I want one of each of my teammates' boards. So I kept them from the 80s. You know, I had five decks that this collector wanted, and they were just shoved in this closet, you know, collecting dust. And this guy really wanted all five of these. And he said, I'll give you $13,000 for all those five decks.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, I'll give you $13,000. And I'm like, and I wanted to buy this Harley Davidson that my friend was selling for 15. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I could take these five decks that are just in a closet collecting dust, and I can have this 1944 flathead Harley that I can race on the beach with all these other motorcycle enthusiasts and hot rodders by just letting someone else have these decks and have them displayed on their wall to look at and be proud of. And here I have this killer vintage 1944 Harley Davidson bike that was in the war.
Wow.
You know, and so, you know, it's all perspective. You know, it's just like, this guy wants these decks. I want this Harley Davidson. Let's make a trade.
It's a fair deal.
A fair deal.
That's awesome, man.
Well, yeah, Steve, we've kept you for a long time, man. I didn't realize how long we kept you already. And this was fun. Thanks for talking to us. I really enjoyed picking your brain. And thanks for, you know, half inventing one of the things I love so much. Even though I was never great at skateboarding, I have a deep, deep love for it and spent a good part of my childhood staring at you and your friends on video. So I appreciate
thank you. Yeah. So I'm stoked, and thank you guys for having me. You guys are great.
Thanks, man. Yeah. We really appreciate your time, dude. It's been a really fun interview.
Yeah. Have a great night. Thanks, Steve.
You too. Thank you guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Well, well, well.
A lot of big subjects there.
We got into it.
Yes, indeed.
We go off track here, and it's a safe place for everyone.
Yes, indeed it is.
You know what I'm saying? And, but I liked a lot of what Steve was talking about. Like, I like the discipline. I like when people talk about, you know, not only the talent, but the discipline and how the people who make it to the step above are the ones who usually just have this.
You do not
fantastic
become,
work ethic. You,
you
know?
Do not become an immortal skater without having crazy discipline. There's no way. There's no fucking way. You have tricks named after you that people are doing 40 years later. You gotta have a lot of discipline.
But the greats, like the great greats, are the people who come around that have like the unique blend of both, right?
Well, yeah, like, you have to have both. That's what I'm saying.
Like, it's not like Tony Hawk and some other guy were just on a totally equal playing field and then Tony Hawk just worked harder. Like, he was uniquely talented then coupled it with the work ethic, right? Like,
yes.
That's when you get the superstars.
Yes, exactly. But my point has always been, and mainly to my kids, to get them to work harder, is that I guarantee that there was a Tony Hawk or a Steve Caballero who had a little bit more talent than either one of those guys. Who's not in the lexicon because they just didn't take that extra like. That those many, 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 many extra steps of just busting their ass to be
1,000%. There's always those weird variables, right? Or even the people, you know, it's something I wish I wished when I was younger was not a part of music and entertainment. But, you know, the more and more years I spend in it, it's pretty obvious it is. But this idea of even how you're presenting yourself,
yeah,
and your aesthetic, and, you know, even Steve back in the day, you know, is rocking his own t-shirts,
yeah,
and just doing things a little bit different to, like, you know, stand out and create his own aesthetic. So it's like this mix of variables, you know. You would like to think that the people who get to the upper echelons of these things do it out of this sheer primal stomach gurgling urge that just comes from within, this divine spirit that's sent to them. But people more likely than not are sitting in their rooms coming up with what they want to be and then just doing it.
Right.
And that's like part of it, you know? I don't know. Like, how many bands sounded like Kiss?
I don't know.
A bunch, right?
Maybe. It's funny you should ask, because I'm actually reading this book, which I don't know if I want to prop it, because it's not turning out as good as I thought it would be. But it's
okay.
It's I almost brought it up because when he said, like, what three bands he was listening to, he said Ace. What did he say?
AC/DC, Cheap Trick, and Aerosmith.
Right. So this book that I'm reading now is actually about Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, Kiss, and this band Stars. Uh-huh. And they were all connected via, like, management and producers, like, really closely. And they all had kind of the same kind of push and the same, but nobody knows who Stars is.
Yeah.
And I went back and listened to Stars. And Stars is the only band that I could think of that kind of sounded like Kiss. I've never heard a band that sounded like Kiss. Like, when was 12 years old and I heard Kiss, that changed my world, because, like, there was nobody with that big crunchy guitar sound. Stars actually sounds a little bit harder.
Interesting.
But it wasn't until the fucking Sex Pistols that you had these, like, crunchy guitars, dude. Like, it just didn't happen. It didn't exist in the 70s. It was, like you said, fucking Steely Dan and fucking Foreigner, dude.
Man, I have been put in my place by you old bastards twice on this podcast. You know, Steve took me down a notch with Machine Gun Kelly. I was going to make the point that the only reason Kiss was famous was because, you know, they dress their drummer up like a space cat, but apparently they were actually a novel band.
Well, I gotta say, there was a good quote in here about Kiss that was, Kiss was smart people making dumb songs for smart people.
Smart people making dumb songs for smart people.
Okay. And for dumb people as well, but that was like
that sounds like some version of just pop music
that's true.
Well, no, I guess I shouldn't say the pop music audience is all smart. I wouldn't say the Kiss listening audience is all smart either.
Most of them are not.
Yeah, I might debate that quote. I might. To ever tell you, the coolest I ever felt was my friend's older brother had a communion party. That's what it's called, right? You Christians do when you're like 15 or 16?
I'm going to say okay. I've never
communion,
been to one.
So I think something like it. That. All I remember is I ate the ear of a pig. But
it's a Catholic thing, I would suppose.
This guy was a big Kiss fan, you know, and my mom was this, like, you know, nerdy record collector and stuff. And she randomly, for some reason, had like a whole thing of sealed Kiss playing cards. And I'm like, oh, can I have a few to give to this guy for his communion? I gotta say, I was like the coolest dude at the party for bringing Kiss trading cards. So big ups to me. But thanks to Steve for coming on this.
Thanks, Steven.
And check out Urethane, the new band. The record's good. The songs are cool. Listen to a lot of it today. It's catchy stuff.
I gotta check it.
Good group. Fun video. Like, nothing wrong with it. It's like what I would want to hear from Southern California punk rock. It's good, you know? So sure, we'll be seeing more of it.
Yeah, you can keep up with all of that at Steve Caballero. The record's out on September 24th officially.
And give us like a review or some stars on the iTunes. We have the Patreon. We've been a little slow last month with Brad jet setting around, doing whatever you do out there.
Saving the world, man. I'm an adventurer.
But, you know, now we're back. We're grounded. Our children must be in school.
Yeah.
So we will be more active on the Patreon, providing more content. And I want everybody to love everybody this week, you know?
Do that.